Today on the podcast, we head to Oklahoma for some fantastic tips about making elegant, edible gardens. I love weaving together edible and ornamental, and I think you'll love our chat with Linda Vodder, author of The Elegant and Edible Garden. Then, we get into school gardens. School gardens that don't fizzle through the summer, as so many do, but instead become a community hub. Sunday Harrison from Green Thumbs Growing Kids tells us about their great model. The Food Garden Life podcast today is a rebroadcast of the radio show that aired live on the 1st of February.
Welcome to the Food Garden Life Show with your hosts Emma and Stephen Biggs, right here on Reality Radio 101. You're listening to the Food Garden Life Show with your hosts Emma and Stephen Biggs. We talk to creative gardeners and food lovers, people who break the rules and make new ones. Emma is a 17-year-old Gen Z gardener, author, and speaker who is crazy about growing tomatoes. She's also the author of Gardening with Emma. Stephen is a horticulture veteran who teaches and writes about food production. And he's also a rule breaker whose Toronto yard has figs, citrus, olives, and all sorts of things he's not supposed to be able to grow. Now, here are your hosts, the daughter and father duo, Emma Biggs and Stephen Biggs.
Hey everyone, happy February, and thanks for hanging out with us today on the Food Garden Life Show. We're the show that brings together gardening, food, and really neat people.
Hey everybody, we sure have a fun show lined up for you today. We start off today's show with something that I'm really passionate about, the ornamental kitchen garden, and really making the kitchen garden look beautiful. And Linda Vodder is the author of a fantastic new book, which is called The Elegant and Edible Garden.
And in the second half of the show, we're looking forward to catching up with Sunday Harrison from Green Thumbs Growing Kids here in Toronto. Sunday and her team at Green Thumbs Growing Kids do amazing work inspiring kids to garden. But there's something else really cool about what we're going to talk about is that they've built a model that solves a really neat challenge of school gardens, which is the summer.
So get on board now. If you have questions, if you have comments, if you just want to give us a shout out, or if you want to put the pressure on me to build that greenhouse for Emma, the studio email address is instudio101@gmail.com.
And now before we get to our guests, how are you doing? You can let us know by emailing us. And I'm really excited because I have tomato seeds for sale up on my website. So for anyone living in Canada who's looking for some really neat tomato varieties to grow this year, you can check that out at emmabiggs.ca. And I'm also going to be teaching a live tomato event on February the 6th, which is this Monday. It's going to be all about everything you need to grow to grow amazing tomatoes this coming year. So you can check that out at foodgardenlife.com on the courses page.
Yeah. And so we are working to put together some really cool courses for this winter and spring, all about gardening, and really focusing on those live courses because we both have so much fun doing that. Last night, I wrapped up my container veggie gardening course and we talked about wicking beds, straw bales, sub-irrigation planters. So look out for more fun stuff, foodgardenlife.com. And if you want to stay in touch with what we're offering, you can just hop on our newsletter list at foodgardenlife.com.
Now back to today's show. Lisa Vodder says that she looks at everything in life through a gardening lens. She's a garden designer in Oklahoma with a passion for making gardens that look great, and her own elegant garden is set around her English Tudor style home in Oklahoma City. And Dad and I have been soaking up the amazing pictures out of her new book, The Elegant and Edible Garden. Linda loves to share a passion for garden design and style in magazines, on TV, and social media, and you can find her online at lisavodder.com.
That's Linda,
sorry. LINDAVATER.com. And she has lots of other cool things going on, which we'll get her to tell you about soon.
And we should also mention her YouTube channel because she's got lots on there and it's really fun. It's all about garden-inspired life.
Now, without further ado, let's get Linda on the line. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. And can I just say, three of the most beautiful words in the English language, live tomato event. To hear those words in the middle of an Arctic blast is just sad for my soul.
Tomato therapy.
Yes.
Well, Linda, I wonder if we could start out today just talking a little bit about how you got into gardening, because it's such a huge part of your life and you're helping so many people garden. But let's step back a bit. Tell us how you got into gardening.
Well, I think I have just always loved plants, and I share a very personal anecdote at the beginning of my book about how I came to be fascinated by plants in general. But I think Emma can probably relate to this. For many of us, I think our gateway drug to gardening would be houseplants. And I just loved raising and tending and maintaining houseplants when I was in high school and in college. I may have been the only college student who picked out her dorm room based on sunlight exposure for her houseplants. And I just became infatuated with growing living things. And then when I had the opportunity at a certain point in my life to build a garden, it was just a natural extension of my love for green and growing things.
You know, houseplants as that gateway drug, that has me thinking back to all the African violets I had in my mom's basement light stand when I was in high school.
And spider plants and philodendron rooting in jars in the window. It's just a wonderful thing.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, though, I'm pretty hopeless with houseplants. I have a few succulents on my windowsill, but I'm not very good with them.
Stick with the tomatoes, Emma.
Yes.
Tomatoes. Linda, you've done something that I really cherish, and you've combined the word elegant with edible. And so often I meet people who think a vegetable garden ought to be hidden in the backyard. And one of the talks I like to give when I'm doing public speaking is about people who opposed a nearby community vegetable garden for fear that it would affect the property values. So you've combined elegant with edible. And I'd just like to dig into this idea of the beautiful kitchen garden. Tell us more.
Well, I think one of the most elegant things is when beautiful form meets beautiful function. And I love combining that, the beautiful ornamental nature of a garden with the practical utility of growing your own food. And I remember, just like it was yesterday, and yet it was over 30 years ago, I was in the Cotswolds in England, and I went and visited Rosemary Very's beautiful potager at Barnsley House. And I literally was seduced by it. And everything about it spoke to me in a very sensual way. I mean, it was visually compelling, obviously, but it was also its orderliness. It was the way it was so easy to navigate, the plant combinations. And to me, so many vegetables are every bit as inherently beautiful as any ornamentals that we can grow in our garden. And so when you kind of break yourself from that mindset that vegetables belong in one place and ornamentals belong in another place, it just opens up a whole world of opportunity for you in garden design and in beautifying your gardening spaces. And she certainly did that and was really amused to me. And I came back and I just saturated myself and immersed myself in all of her writings. And it's a sensual experience. It's not just a garden. It was the way the light hit the garden. It was the fragrance of the herbs and the plantings. It was, the sound of the pea gravel paths that she walked on. It was the romance of going out in the early morning to clip for your dinner that night from your own garden. And, you know, down to even the squeaking of the garden gate as you go into it, it was just so experiential on every level, in such a romantic, but also in a very practical way. And it absolutely seduced me. And I just decided that I needed to have that in my Oklahoma garden. And let me tell you, it's a lot harder to do that here in Oklahoma than it is in gardening heaven. But I managed to create something that I think is quite beautiful.
Well, what are some of the things that you took from that garden and used to influence your own garden?
Well, I think I'm a very word-oriented person. I love words. And so when I was touring the garden, I wrote down words that described it. And then in addition to the pictures I took, I came home and I just really deconstructed both of those things. And I had to figure out a way to translate it from her garden context into my garden context, or what I refer to in my book as good gardening fit. So, and there are ways that you can do that using some of those identifiable terms that I had. So I may not be able to do it in an English accent, but I was able to do it with an Oklahoma twang, if you will. And so if I couldn't get the look I wanted with a plant that she could grow, then I would just try to translate that into a horticultural doppelganger that would work in my own garden, which is much drier, much windier, much hotter, and with much and far greater extremes. And so it was a matter of horticultural and vernacular translation. And once I kind of figured that out and put it into my own gardening constraints, you know, in terms of how much space I had and how much time I had, it kind of all came together.
I love that idea of horticultural translation, so that you're creating a feel similar to what you saw, but you're making it work in your particular setting.
Oh, yes, because certainly the way you two garden up in Canada is a far cry from how I garden down here. But if I look at things like a plant's line, shape, and form, and then down to, you know, the intricacies of things like different varieties and what varieties will work here. And, you know, we all have that kind of frustration that we want to grow what we can't. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to look at it more through the opportunistic lens of what can I grow? You know, I can get probably boatloads of basil all summer long, that for those farther north would be a challenge. And so you just have to look at it through the lens of what your gardening zone can do and what it can do well, and then exploit that to the maximum.
That really is a really great way to think about the garden, because so often I find myself complaining, oh, I wish I had more space and more tomato varieties and I could grow this, but I am so fortunate with all that I can grow here.
Yeah. And you know, there's the yin and yang to everything. A large garden is wonderful, but a large garden has to be maintained. Mm-hmm. And so we do what we can given the constraints of the areas and the geography in which we garden. And again, I really walk through what constitutes good garden fit, and how that garden fit changes over time. So what I grew what I grow in my potager very much was informed by what was happening in my life. And as your life changes, how you garden changes. So when I was younger and my kids were much younger and were at home, I grew things in a certain kind of way. Now that they are grown men and they live away, I then garden in a different way based on how my life has changed. And I think that a garden that is flexible enough to accommodate your lifestyle changes and things of that nature really speaks to what is a very successful garden.
Yeah. Well, can you walk us through your protégé garden? What does it look like when people first walk in?
Well, first of all, it is a destination garden, and I have to say it's a little bit bittersweet for me to do this because after gardening in that spot for 32 years, I have recently moved. And I am starting a whole new garden. And so if I sound a little bit sentimental, it's because I just this month moved away from that garden space. But nevertheless, its contours will always be with me. And I would first of all define it by calling it a destination garden. So some people want to have their herbs and veggies and their kitchen items very, very close to their kitchen, right outside their door. For me, I wanted it to be a place that I would go to that had a certain kind of awayness to it. And so it is, even though my property was small, it's a destination that you would then walk to. And it was hidden behind guest quarters. The home was built in 1932, so it's hidden behind the guest quarters, which created very much a natural room. So as soon as I saw that room that was defined by walls and fences and things, I could then in my imagination see a kitchen garden there. And I then took what I considered to be kind of just a section of Rosemary Very's garden and downsized it. And then I just place it and designed it so that it would fit in that space with paths so that I could access all different compartments within the potager. So a potager is a decorative vegetable garden, and it literally translates to soup garden, potage being French for soup. So when you go in, you immediately, and everything is aligned on axis. So when you would walk through the gate or the arbor, you immediately would walk into and be presented by what I considered to be two stylized hearts that faced one another with a circle in the middle. And so what that did was with the brick paths that are fashioned in so many images in my book, it divided it quite naturally into four different quadrants or four different little areas that I could then plant. And what I love about that is it not only helped me create something that was visually beautiful, but also gave a certain kind of organization to not only how I gardened, but how I worked. So in one day, you know, it can get up to 115 Fahrenheit here in Oklahoma. And it's hard to garden under those kind of conditions. But if I could go out in the cool of the morning and say, okay, today I'm going to do this one compartment and I'm going to work in this one area with the, you know, with the tomatoes and the basil and the oregano. And then tomorrow I can do this other compartment. So it also it brought organization to the chaos that can sometimes be a garden. And then the contours of that were basically a long rectangle vertically set. And then to the left of that, there was a flower border, where I also grew some edibles and herbs, but largely ornamentals that were a cutting garden. And then there would be different focal points that could change over the years. So, I mean, I would grow miniature pumpkins when my kids were little in the circle in the middle of the boxwood hedged potager. And later I did something as simple as like an olive urn. So those things just changed over time. And the boxwood provides such beautiful structure that it was attractive at any time of year, beautiful with snow in the winter, but equally as beautiful when it was just filled to the gills with all sorts of summer bounty.
I don't know if I'm using the right word, but as I look at the picture on the cover of your book, I'm feeling as if the boxwood is almost like a backbone to the garden.
Oh, very much so, Stephen. Very much so. It's good garden bones. And it's and the thing is, if you look at it, it would be beautiful even if there were nothing planted in it. Mm-hmm. It just structurally makes the garden make sense. And then I could kind of, to a certain extent, expand or contract what I planted based on weather conditions, based on how busy I was or whatever. But beautiful, nothing's more beautiful than that beautifully clipped boxwood hedge with bright light Swiss chard and new pearl cherry tomatoes in it and all sorts of different kinds, a tapestry of basil and things. And it's not large. So a lot of the vegetables that I would grow would be miniature vegetables, dollhouse gardening, I called it. And it was just enough so that every day, typically even in the winter, I could have something fresh daily from my garden.
Okay. I want to dig a little bit more into the process of design. Before I do, just a shout out to Florence, who wrote in to say she's really enjoying our chat and also welcoming Emma back to the show. So thank you, Florence. And Linda, for people who are now excited about this idea of this meeting of form and function in the edible garden, walk us through maybe some of the thoughts that would go through your head as you're creating a dream garden.
Well, I think you start out, or for me, the process started out, and I talk about this extensively in my book, by asking yourself a lot of questions. So how you want to garden, I think self-awareness is crucial. And so for me, I knew that I wanted to garden primarily in certain seasons, in the spring and in the fall, not in the heat of the summer. So that told me then that these are the kinds of vegetables I might want to grow based on the seasonality of it. If you are, for example, someone who travels all summer, but you are there in, you know, the remainder of the year, then those are the seasons you would want to focus on. The most obvious thing is, what do you like to eat? I love fresh greens. And so for me, and cooking with herbs, so my garden was always very greens and herb intensive. And also because of certain kinds of just size constraints. So what do you like to eat, and what does your family like to eat? My boys loved peppers, so I grew lots of poblano peppers and sweet peppers and things like that. So what do you like to eat? What do you find beautiful? I love to bring the outdoors indoors. So nothing is more poetic to me than a beautiful clump of cherry tomatoes on a blue willow platter. And so visually, I'm very big fan of constant spry. And so I quite frequently use a lot of my edibles in flower arrangements. So what kind of things would I want to incorporate into flower arranging? So you ask a lot of questions about how you live your life, and that informs what you plant and how you garden.
I love that. Maybe if we can go further and look at some of these design elements that are common in these ornamental edible gardens. And I think the idea of enclosure is somewhere I'd love to start. And you've talked about how that really jumped out at you the first time that you saw this garden in England. And of course, in your own garden, you had a fence around it and you've got all the boxwoods. But tell us more about this idea of enclosure.
Well, I think enclosure is one of many design principles. And let me digress a little bit, Stephen, because first of all, I am not professionally trained. I am just a self-taught gardener that just learned this stuff by trial and error. So I don't want any of your listeners to feel intimidated by this process and think, oh, I have to be a garden designer, or I have to have a degree or whatever. You really, really don't. because so many of these design principles, enclosure being amongst them, are just intuitive. And if you just start paying attention, you'll realize just how intuitive they are. So when I turned the corner and I saw that there was this enclosed space, this garden room, if you will, I loved that sense of enclosure and that garden being circumscribed by fences and walls. I love the feeling of intimacy it gave me. I love being able to walk into a space that was enclosed. From a practical standpoint, being on the Great Plains, it served as a nice windbreak. It gave me some privacy because I live in an urban neighborhood, so it gave me some privacy. And enclosure can do so many of those things for you. And design can serve your purpose. So if you ask yourself, okay, privacy is important to me, or boy, wind is a problem, then you set up your garden in a way that enclosure becomes paramount. And the other thing is there's layers of enclosure. So there's enclosures within enclosure. So that garden room is one room that is enclosed by a structure, by fences, and then by a smaller fence. So that's enclosed. But then there's enclosure within, because each one of those compartments within the boxwood potager are enclosed. And so there are different layers of enclosure that then you press into service based on what your garden needs are.
Okay. Well, we don't have a ton of time left, but we want to talk about your book because it's filled with lots of other great design ideas. What was the inspiration to write it?
I think it was just opportunity meets putting in a lot of years of gardening. So I've gardened here for 32 years. I've done a TV segment. I have a YouTube channel and things of that nature. And so during COVID, a publisher just contacted me and said, would you write a book? And I thought, why not? What else am I going to do? So we came up with the concept, and I had documented, and this is another important thing for listeners, you know, just take a million pictures, pretty pictures, ugly pictures, and document the progression and evolution of a garden over time, because I was able to tap into that deep well of images that I had over 32 years, in addition to a lot of the magazine shoots that had been done here and things. And so I was able to put words to those images, and hopefully in a way that really speaks to people and makes gardening and beautiful gardening accessible.
Okay, and it really is a beautiful book. And you said earlier that you've recently moved. Does that mean there's going to be a new garden?
Yeah, there's going to be a new garden. It's going to look a little bit different because, again, I have to match the constraints of where I garden. But I wanted to create another garden before I got too old to do so. And I kind of feel like I had maxed out on that other garden in my ideas. So I needed new ground. To start a new garden. And I'm so excited. And I am documenting this process on my YouTube channel so people can follow along and they can see all of the issues that I am dealing with and how this one will be different from the last one, different, but not necessarily better or worse, and how you start a garden from scratch if you've never done it before. So if people want to follow along on that pilgrimage, then they can follow me on my YouTube channel at just Google Linda Vauder and it will come up.
And tell everyone what else you're up to and where they can find you online.
Well, they can find me on YouTube, where it's all about garden-inspired living indoors and out. They can find me on Instagram. They can sign up for my website or go to my website, lindavauder.com. I sometimes do a regular gardening segment here on our local NBC affiliate, KFOR. I have a garden journal coming out soon. I'm working on a beautiful 5-year garden journal that people will be able to find. And I also have a gardening ornamental product line on QVC. So lots of irons in the fire. Oh, and I'm starting a new garden.
My goodness. I was just going to say, I don't know how you find the time to garden with so many things going on.
Well, fortunately, it's winter right now, and it's a blessed respite from how, as you guys know, how frantic it gets when gardening season begins.
It sure does. Well, Linda, thanks so much for the inspiration today and sharing those thoughts on the ornamental edible garden. And congratulations on such a beautiful book. The Elegant and Edible Garden is really gorgeous.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me on your program.
Thanks, Linda.
Thanks, Emma.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That was garden designer Linda Vodder, author of a beautiful book, The Elegant and Edible Garden. And you can find her online at lindavodder.com. So lindavater.com. And remember, check out that YouTube channel too, because it really is great. Lots of, and I love her term, garden inspired living.
Now, coming up in just a moment, have you ever watched a little kid marvel at a bug or squeal with delight getting dirty hands? Well, we're talking to someone who helps make that happen. Sunday Harrison from Green Thumbs Growing Kids here in Toronto joins us in just a minute. You're listening to the Food Garden Life Show. I'm Emma Biggs.
We'd love it if you keep in touch between radio shows. What do you like about the show? What would you find useful? Just message us at foodgardenlife.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we hang out under the handle Food Garden Life. Emma is also on Instagram as EmmaBiggs_grows, and her website is emmabiggs.ca. And some shout outs today. First of all, to Katie, who just sent in a picture of figs in a greenhouse. Katie, thank you. I would like one of those, definitely. And to Irene, who just sent in a note from Orlando, giving a shout out to Emma. So thank you both. And after our last radio show, Darlene sent in a note to say it was good to have Emma back on the show. And thanks, Darlene. I felt the same way. I quite missed her when she was all wrapped up in school activities and sports. And to Jim, thank you for the greenhouse picture. We're still working on that greenhouse plan, but I can tell you that the cold frames are all ready to go for Emma's 2023 tomato seedlings. And Anne, thanks for checking in about today's show. And to Annette, thank you for pointing us towards another tomato addict.
Yeah, well, speaking of tomatoes, I'm teaching an online event this coming Monday, which is February the 6th, all about how to take care of tomatoes for an epic harvest this year. So everything you know, need to know to plant them, train them, take care of them, save seeds, of course. So you can grab your spot at foodgardenlife.com. Just go to the courses page. And I'm also selling tomato seeds. So if you live in Canada and you're looking for some neat varieties, check out my website, emmabiggs.ca.
Emma and I also have weekly podcasts between these live monthly radio shows. And what we've been up to since the last show is we had one guest talking about her tomato addiction. So kind of a kindred spirit with Emma, and she's in Grey County, Ontario. And then we had an Ontario market gardener, Brian French, and he's growing forest rhubarb through the winter. I think the only one in Ontario. So we learned all about how that works. And then Sam Hubert from One Green World Nursery in Oregon told us all about hardy citrus. And new on the website since last month, we have a seed shopping guide with lingo. We've got information on how to start tomato seeds indoors. Hey, Emma.
Yeah.
And I've got my mom's beet borscht recipe. So if you're into beets and you like borscht, you got to check that out. It's as good as mom made.
It sure is good. Well, next we're going to dig into a really neat group here in Toronto that makes gardening possible for school kids in the downtown area. Sunday Harrison is the founder and executive director of Green Thumbs Growing Kids, a Toronto nonprofit organization that provides hands-on garden and food education to urban school children.
Sunday joined us on the show a while back to talk about some of the great things that she's seen happen in school gardens. But today we're going to dig into a common challenge that school gardens face, and that's summertime. It might sound funny because summer is also the growing season, but it's also when it's really hard to find people to help in a school garden. You can find Sunday and Green Thumbs Growing Kids online at greenthumbsto.org. So greenthumbsto, T-O for Toronto.org. And if you have questions about school gardens, you can email right now at instudio101@gmail.com. So without further ado, let's get Sunday on the line. Hey, Sunday.
Hey.
Thanks so much for joining us on the show today. We're so excited to talk about Green Thumbs Growing Kids.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love talking about gardening on February 1st.
Yes. Well, it's so cold and snowy.
Yes.
Well, maybe we should give a little introduction to the group just for people who didn't hear the last episode. So give us sort of in broad sweeps, what is Green Thumbs Growing Kids?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization that I think we're in our 24th season upcoming in downtown East Toronto. We partner with a cluster of elementary schools, and that means that we've helped to establish their gardens and maintain them, and most importantly, program with elementary children through the school year. So basically September to June, offering curriculum-linked programming and extracurricular as well. And then in the summer, really turning that space into a community asset. So that's been our model. We're in three schools for many, many years. And then we occasionally do kind of one-offs or like a workshop series in schools outside of that cluster. It's a capacity issue. Like we were kind of reached our, our zenith, our space of, you know, we've elevated to the height of our incompetence or something like that.
You haven't been able to clone yourselves.
Right. Like, you know, we're working in a system that does not recognize school grounds as part of the education system. So we're kind of a bit of a unicorn. And, we would like to clone ourselves. So just, get in touch if you if you have a petri dish to help that happen. So basically the model is to attend to each of those three gardens one day per week and run programs for the kids and the teachers that sign up. It's completely voluntary. They don't have to, but basically we'll send an email out at the end of a month and your school can sign up every Wednesday in the following month. Here's the program ideas. We're also really blessed with a number of placement students from a variety of programs, including teacher candidates, child and youth care workers, sociology students, if you can believe it, and nursing students. And so, for example, last year, 2022, we had 29 placement students throughout the year.
Wow. So
basically we can bring, it's a fractal. It's, we're all learning from the garden. The garden's teaching us all, and the people who want to become teachers get to learn how to teach in a garden. And so basically what is beautiful about it is that the ratio of adults to children is very high. And so what that means is that kids can be broken off into small groups and each group gets a hands-on activity. We all know that gardening is, not that much fun in theory, but once you do it, you have fun and you learn stuff. And it's really great for basically preschool. We have some preschool programming. The kids come with their parents, usually moms, and, you know, basically they do a lot of watering.
Yes, fun and, for little kids.
Right. And then into kindergarten, where they can really start to plant seeds and understand the growth of a plant. They don't get all the science until grade three science. But there's certainly lots of science links throughout the K to eight curriculum. I'd say most of our buy-in is K to six. But we are doing some work with middle school as well. Each of those schools, two out of three, have middle school, 7, 8. And so working with those, you know, that little kind of, you know, a little too cool for school, but like, you know, Emma, you remember, you know,
oh, yeah.
You probably had other things on your mind besides gardening. In that age group, which, yeah, how old are you now?
I'm 17.
Oh my goodness.
I don't feel time like does
it. Fly. Yeah. So, yeah. So imagine, you know, when you're 12 and 13, it can be a little bit of a challenge, but, you know, we just have to kind of be where people are at. Like, you know, there's something for everyone, for every age group in the garden. But back to the sort of policy, world that we live in, school grounds are not in the funding formula for education. So they're basically just like, you get whatever you get at whatever school you go to, whether there's large grounds or small grounds or sports fields or tennis courts or whatever there is just, you know, kind of, it's just there. It's kind of considered recreational. So using school grounds for education is something that I think the Americans have really come a much longer ways than we have in Canada. And even in Canada, in the West, in Vancouver and in British Columbia more generally, there's a lot more school gardens. So, you know, we're kind of come bringing up the rear, but I guess what we wanted to kind of cover today was sort of how our model works. And I would say that there are lots of school gardens that get started, and there's usually a sort of parent champion and a teacher champion, and, you know, there could be a few families who volunteer over the summer to water. But sometimes those gardens don't last. And it's not to say that it's a failure. It was good for the period that it was. But so people on the outside and people in the education system look at that and they go, oh, well, school gardens don't work. Well, if you tweak the model a bit and have an organization like ours that partners with a cluster of schools, so there's kind of an efficiency of scale.
Yes.
And then what we do is we hire local youth, thanks to the federal government's Canada Summer Jobs Program. Every summer we are given an allocation of, you know, between 3 and 6 staff to help run the gardens. And it's programming for the local children who, most of whom in our neighborhood, they don't have yards. They might have a balcony if they're lucky. So coming into the garden in the summertime is fun, and there's water mm-hmm. and, you know, stuff to do and shade. And it's not like your previous guests in Oklahoma, where it's too hot to be in the garden. I mean, that we do have some of those days, and most of our summer programming is, in fact, in the morning. And then we kind of retreat to the indoor spaces in the afternoon.
But you talked about gardens being a community asset in the summer. So now you've created this space where these kids who maybe don't have a balcony or a yard, they can get outside. And you have, it sounds like, programming to also engage and stimulate them.
Yeah. So most of kids in our neighborhood are in day camps through the summer. Like maybe they go away for a couple of weeks if they're lucky. So they're mostly in town. And, you know, just remember that, like, you know, summer, the whole idea of being off school in the summer was so that you could go home and help on the farm. So this is our version of that. And so we partner with the day camps just in the same way that we would partner with the teachers during the school year. We send out an email. We say, come to the garden at 10 a.m. We'll be there. We'll do fun stuff. And you can take the food back to your center and cook with it. So that's what happens to the food in the summer. During the school year, the food hopefully goes into a student lunch program, a nutrition program, or into classrooms. Or we even do simple recipes in the garden. So yeah, I went on to the food piece because most of the gardens are food gardens. They're not exclusively food gardens. We kind of have like a food forest kind of design to our gardens where we're growing also trees and shrubs and other, you know, plants, not just human edible, but also, you know, bird edible and bee pollinable. And, you know, the garden is for every creature, not just us humans. And it's a place to enjoy nature as it is in a biodiverse, you know, urban neighborhood, that biodiverse, natural environment is so special when you don't have access to that. And, you know, even school grounds are generally not biodiverse. They're usually, even the green spaces are kind of, you know, turf and trees. Nothing against trees. They're good for shade and we need them. But, you know, plants that you can touch and plants that you can smell and plants that you can rub between your fingers and see bugs and learn composting and all of the other stuff that happens in an active garden space. So yeah, it becomes, so what we are doing is taking what is an obstacle in, if you're just doing a single school, the summer becomes kind of a barrier. Mm-hmm. But when you group the schools together and have a little bit more labor to rotate through the schools, it becomes, you know, a community asset. So that's where not only do we run programs for the day camps, but we'll have like a family drop in for, you know, after school or after work, you know, 5 to 7 p.m. Just come and pick off the produce, take it home. We'll have youth specific programs, learning about urban agriculture, learning about composting. You know, a little bit more of the entrepreneurial side of gardening. So taking produce to market, we have a local, farmers market that we attend, that we bring our produce to, when it's not donated, it's sold. Also to give people experience in running a market stall, handling cash, talking to customers about the produce that they've grown. So that's all part of it.
It's always amazing to me how many different skills can be taught through gardening.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we just had an email come in from Tim, and thank you, Tim. And Tim's asking Sunday whether Green Thumbs Growing Kids takes donations, and if so, how?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a registered charity, so donations are tax deductible. And there's a link right on our website to our Canada Helps page where we are happy to accept donations. We also accept donations of stuff, depending on what it is. We have limited storage, but you know, if you have that old extra wheelbarrow kicking around that you don't need, we could probably put it to use. Pots and trays, you know, we pretty much try to wash and recycle everything. Money donations are wonderful. We do kind of, it is a bit of a shoestring, like, you know, most charities, but thanks to many individual donors and landscape sponsors, such as Emma and Stephen Biggs, we've had great success in the past few years. And I think COVID actually didn't hurt us so much financially as some other types of organizations and operations. I mean, gardening got kind of sexy and everybody wanted to do it. And so, you know, yeah. I'm not saying we're rolling in it, but like, you know, it could have been worse. And our school board is actually more supportive than ever because they're getting calls from schools saying, hey, how do we get what Green Thumbs is doing and how can we have a garden that is sustainable?
We should mention too, you have a coloring book that is a fundraiser, but it's also something that's great for people with little kids who they're trying to get thinking about gardening at this time of year. So that is also on the website, which is greenthumbsto.org.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. It was a really fun project and has a variety of styles, of drawing styles. Different artists have passed through the organization and donated their work. And our wonderful board of directors put it all together in a coloring book. So yeah, it's a great gift for, I would say kids 6 to 12 would be kind of the ideal age.
Great. Well, can you tell us about the upcoming roof garden project?
Oh yeah. We're so excited to have a green roof to work with. There's only, you know, 5 inches of grow media. But it's at our office at Daniel Spectrum in Regent Park. And it's south-facing. The thing with rooftops is that you don't have the squirrel pressure.
I love the sound of that.
Right? I mean, we had geese, which, you know, might sound cute, but they actually had to be relocated because the goslings would die if they fell off the roof. Oh. So we ended up having wonderful folks from Toronto Wildlife Service come and pick them up and take them to a pond. But we've also learned a lot about pollinators through having that space. And one of the suggestions for that space as a green roof was to run a social enterprise and consider having bees for honey. So our staff thought about that and did some research and found that honeybees could outcompete native bees for pollen sources. So we thought, well, if there's only honeybees visiting our rooftop, then maybe it would be okay. Well, we did a pollinator survey, which involves going out and counting pollinators, species, on your rooftop with, you know, all the wonderful flowers that were planted. And there were 70 odd species of bees and pollinators coming by. So we thought, no, maybe we won't do beehives for honey. We want to keep our native pollinators happy. So we're not going to be selling honey anytime soon. Maybe we'll do cut flowers as a social enterprise. I don't know. Those are the immediate need is to get a perimeter fence around the space. It's 10,000 square feet of beautiful green roof, but there's no perimeter fence, so we can't invite members of the public out there. It's just for staff only to do the cultivation. So we have a defense fund to get that problem solved so that we could ultimately have members of the public be able to come out and see what you can do with a green roof if you want to grow food on it. And we actually had an amazing amount of food production. Crazy things like a squash left from prior year on the ground actually sprouted because there's warmth from the space below. So you've got self-seeding squash in Toronto.
I love it. So, right? So just a little hint to listeners who are excited about kids and gardening, defense fund. If anybody wants to step up and help out, you can check out greenthumbsto.org. And Sunday, I wanted to, while we still have time, also let people know about this cool project that you have from trees to trees from seed.
Trees from seed. Yeah, thank you.
That's maybe a way people could, if they want to do something, work with your organization. So tell us about that.
Yeah, for sure. So we've found a few species of native trees native to this region, that grow fairly easily from seed. And so we've developed a children's program to grow them out. And so we have we have tree nurseries on our three school grounds, where the tree seedlings will live for a few years. We'll be looking for more land. If you have land that is in the GTA that could accept some trees, you could let us know. We're kind of going to be on the lookout because really, you know, there's an intermediate stage till the trees are really ready, large enough to go out onto school properties or onto residential properties. Most people don't want a baby tree. They want it to be a certain size when they put it in the ground. So getting the trees from seed to that size is the fun challenge we have ahead, but the germination is great. The species we're really keen on is called Kentucky coffee tree. There's a lot of them planted in Toronto because they're very urban tolerant. And they're a fun tree like to learn about. There's a male and a female. And so the female has these beautiful big brown pods you've probably seen if you're in Toronto or farther south, because Toronto is actually the top of trees range. I've heard it can go a little bit farther north, but I'm just not sure about the winter for the tree and when it gets too cold. But anyways, yeah, trees from seed, lots of fun, and a fun way to teach plant science and talk about climate, talk about healthy soil. So those are all the connections that we can make.
Beautiful. Well, we're huge fans, Sunday. We love what you do. And thank you for what you do. And thanks for hanging out today on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye, Sunday.
Bye-bye.
That was Sunday Harrison, the founder and executive director of Green Thumbs Growing Kids, a Toronto nonprofit organization that provides hands-on garden and food education to urban school children. You can find them at greenthumbsto.org, and you can also donate there.
Well, the Food Garden Life show is just about over for today. So a big thanks to Sunday Harrison, to Linda Vauder, for joining us on the show, for great ideas about edible garden design and gardening with kids. And a shout out to Gary, our producer, who makes this first Wednesday of every month so much fun. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who wrote in today, to Florence, Katie, Irene, Karen, and Tim.
And we'd love to hear from you before our next show. Make sure you connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, where we hang out at Food Garden Life. And you can also find me on Instagram at EmmaBiggs_grows and on my website, emmabiggs.ca. Now, who do you want to hear on the show? Are we getting things right? Make sure you send us a note from foodgardenlife.com.
You're listening to the Food Garden Life Show. I'm Stephen Biggs.
And I'm Emma Biggs. Have a great month, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Food Garden Life Show with your hosts, Stephen and Emma Biggs, right here on Reality Radio 101.